This is 72745 Silva versus Mathis. If parties are ready to proceed, for the appellant, Tammy Crowden. And if you wish to reserve, please so state.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please. May it please the court, my name is Tammy Calvin, here representing Sean Silva, appellant who is here in the courtroom. I actually want to begin somewhat as an aside. In preparing for this argument, I read my opening brief, and I'm mortified at the typos in it, and I extend my apologies to the court. It's long been my practice with pro bono cases that I don't sort of volunteer other people in the firm to work on them. But I think when it comes to proofreading, I really need to ask for some help. So I wanted to apologize for that. I'm assuming the court's familiar with the facts. Mm-hmm. And so unless there are any questions about the facts, I'll just proceed with the argument. I think... First of all, it's very clear this case does need to be reversed, if only because Mr. Silva unquestionably had standing for a visitation determination. So for that purpose, it clearly needs to be reversed. But in that reversal, or in vacating that matter and sending it back to instruction with instructions, we're here to ask the court to consider the adoption of a policy that is would uniformly apply the best interest of the child standard to determinations that are so crucial to the child, in this case, parentage. This court has recognized the doctrine of equitable adoption, and it has applied factors that essentially exist in this case with one exception, and that there was no formal agreement that the party, that Mr. Silva would adopt Damien. However, there was a de facto agreement because Ms. Mathis encouraged Mr. Silva to develop father-son relationship with Damien, right almost from the child's birth. And that relationship did develop. They lived together for the majority of the child's life so far. They had been living together with Damien, or I'm sorry, with Mr. Silva as Damien's father. At one point, in fact, Damien and Mr. Silva lived together without Ms. Mathis being present in the home. And this was with Ms. Mathis's permission, her encouragement. It was facilitating Damien's participation in a school program that was beneficial to him because he has some special needs. So it really comes down to basically, is a formal adoption, a formal agreement to adoption, what is really important, or is what is important, the relationship between the de facto parent and the child? And ironically, I'm not sure I have much more to say than that. It truly does, to me, come down to that, but I'm sure you have questions. Justice Cherry.
I was thinking if Ms. Mathis got married, that new husband may want the right to be the father of this child. Is there a policy issue here?
Well, in this court's recognized that a child can have two mothers. Now, in this case, Damien's genetic father is deceased, never had any relationship with the child, but he is deceased. So this would not be a case of two fathers. But in the event that Ms. Mathis were to remarry or even develop another relationship similar, I shouldn't say remarry, if she were to marry or develop another relationship with a gentleman who also she wished to encourage to have a parent-child relationship, then it can only be beneficial that then the boy can have two fathers in his life. That's not a bad thing. And it happens all the time in many cases where I myself remarried and my daughter had a step-parent.
I had four stepmothers.
Pardon me?
I had four stepmothers. So
four stepmothers. Yeah. Well, that's interesting, but if you develop the relationship with all four of them, that can only be beneficial for the child. So I don't see that as a competing issue. As long as there's some mutual respect among the various de facto parents and some recognition that it's what's in the best interest of the child.
How would you write this if you were going to write this opinion order? How would you write it? What would you say?
I would adopt the de facto parent test that has been adopted in numerous cases. I could list them for you, but de facto parent test is basically that there be the parent-child relationship has developed with the permission and encouragement of the natural parent or the legal parent, and that there would be a detrimental effect if that relationship were not continued. And I'm forgetting one off the top of my head. I know there's another. I think I conflated two factors there. But
Ms. Cotton, if I could ask you this on the, do you think supplemental briefings necessary in this case? And I realize you took it pro bono, so we appreciate that. And opposing counsel, they can bring up this important issue. But I don't know if the respondents had a chance to really weigh in on this de facto parent doctrine sufficiently. So what's your thoughts on that? Mm.
Well, I think they did have the opportunity and chose not to accept it. But obviously, if the court feels it should be addressed further, I have no objection, and I will continue the representation and participate in any further briefing the court wishes.
Why should the court adopt this, opposed to leaving it for the legislature?
Well, why did the court adopt it when the court determined that a child could have two mothers? Because, if I may, and you can correct me, obviously, but I believe it was because the courts recognize that the legislature has already indicated that biology does not govern parentage, and that the best interest of the child is what should be the basis for determining the matters related to the child's welfare, including, in this case, parentage.
Ms. Cowden, in St. Mary's, we are two mothers. In Boynes, we have our two fathers. Both of those are, do you think it's a distinction without a difference that in both of those you had two individuals come together to agree to enter into the parenting situation together? In Boynes, it was two fathers who agreed to adopt who could not otherwise both adopt. So that's how they took the child, no biological relationship with either of them. In St. Mary's, you had two mothers, and there was at least there was a biological component to both, but both entered into almost a contract to have a baby together. Here you're talking about parentage is not in question. We know who the parents are. You're talking about somebody who is in a relationship who potentially would be divesting one of the parents of their time. Why isn't the custodial provisions for non-parents or visitation sufficient to cover this type of situation?
Well, there were several questions there. So
sure, sorry. Go.
First of all, in terms of the difference between the Wynn and, I want to say St. Mary's, it's not St. Mary's, but the mother case, where they decided before anyone developed a parent-child relationship. Mm-hmm. I don't think it makes any difference to the child. And that's where the focus should be, is the child. The fact that in this case it was a couple months after the birth of the child that she welcomed Mr. Silva into her child's life and encouraged him to be a father, to me does not make a tremendous difference. And certainly it wouldn't make any to the child. In all of these cases, the child developed a relationship with the non-legal parent. So that's the answer for the first question. For in terms of why the existing statutes that allow appointment of custody or visitation, one of the distinction for custody is that there's a preference for the legal parent. It's only if the legal parent is found to be unsatisfactory in some way, detrimental, actively detrimental, that the non-parent, the others in the line of preference, can be granted custody. So this will be placing the two who together did co-parent the child, regardless of when that, whether that agreement was formal or not, or when it, that agreement started, it places them on an equal footing. If you can meet the factors, and I recognize that in this case, we only have allegations, there's never been any response, so you'd have to make that determination here. But assuming the factors for a de facto parent are satisfied, then the two parents should be on an equal footing.
But so for de facto parenting, you wouldn't have to establish unfitness, correct?
Correct.
But to get custody, you have to establish unfitness.
For de facto parent, you have to determine it's in the best interest of the child, and you have to determine that the legal parent welcomed and fostered and encouraged the relationship. So actively brought this person into her or his child's life deliberately. Those factors would be sufficient to overcome what I suspect you're leading to, which is the constitutional right for to control the parenting of your child. By encouraging and fostering that relationship, that person has expressed a choice. And what we're saying now is, because that relationship is developed, to terminate it would be detrimental to the child. And that's where you weigh the two, and the best interest of the child is what would prevail. Am I down to three?
Does it matter that there's an allegation of unfitness of the mother? Should it matter in this case? So we make that rule that you're saying it doesn't matter whether there's allegations, but should it matter?
Well,
about the allegations. I mean, they're only allegations at this time.
The only allegation that is supposed to be made is just a bare allegation of unfitness. And in here there was more detail, and that was improper, but we should recall that Mr. Silva was unrepresented. But in terms of should it make a factor as to whether the court should adopt a de facto parent? No, because I don't think de facto parent... In some ways, de facto parenthood would be the opposite of finding unfitness, because the legal parent, at least at one point, chose to bring this person into the child's life, and that is a positive. So the fact that they now want to terminate it could, in fact, be the detrimental, the issue of unfitness or detrimental harm to the child, which some courts have specifically found. State of Washington, and I think Utah as well, that can serve as the factor. But I don't think that should be the determinative issue in this case, no.
Why is it necessary for us to reach the de facto parent doctrine? Isn't 125C sufficient to address this issue and this dispute?
Well, it's certainly sufficient to the extent Mr. Silva were only seeking visitation. But he's not. He's seeking custody. And for that, there's no parity under the existing statutes. For the two co-parents, without a de facto parenthood doctrine, then Ms. Mathis will always have the preference, and there will have to be an express finding, even for a joint custody arrangement. I think there would have to be an express finding that she is in some way unfit, or that it would be detrimental to the child to place the child with her.
Well, certainly the only issue in front of this court at this time is your client's standing to pursue the complaint. And it would seem that at least with respect to a claim for visitation under 125C, he had standing to do that.
Yes, I agree. He absolutely had standing for that. But he asked for more.
I beg your pardon?
He asked for custody.
Right, but shouldn't assuming that he gets the pleading straightened out below, if we were to send it back, maybe we should not jump into a doctrine the legislature hasn't adopted and our research suggests has multiple factors depending upon which state you look at in dealing with the de facto parent doctrine. I'm concerned about reaching that question at this early stage and letting the facts develop in the district court first.
Well, I guess if the court made it clear that the court below could consider the issue, because without there being an existing de facto doctrine, there's no guarantee the court will look at those factors and make that determination. The court could simply say, no, you don't have standing under the UPA, or Nevada's Parentage Act. You don't have standing in these circumstances because of the potentially rebutted presumption of paternity.
Well, it does seem like adopting the doctrine first and then secondly establishing what factors are included within the doctrine is a bit advisory at this stage without counsel advocating in the district court first for the doctrine, and secondly, letting the district court address that subject first. And suppose the district court rejects the notion that respondent has any fault of any kind, then the de facto doctrine may not even apply. I mean, factually, if you recognize your client is seeking custody, and has pled or set forth pleadings that go beyond probably what they should be, but the essence of getting custody is to show that mom's unfit.
Under the
district court
were to conclude that she's not, then I'm not sure that we would be into a de facto parent doctrine case anyway.
De facto parenthood does not require a finding.
I get that, but
so. Is that you're actually expressing the point of why there should be a determination of whether this doctrine is recognized in Nevada, so that the court below, in addressing the issues here, has guidance for what determinations to make. Now, Mr. Silva did present allegations that would be sufficient to satisfy a de facto parenting test that has been adopted by, I think, at least six or seven jurisdictions, Colorado, Washington, Utah, Kentucky, I believe, all have the same similar factors which focus on best interest of the child, that disrupting the relationship would be detrimental, that the legal parent fostered the development of the relationship, and that relationship does exist.
Well, in any of those cases in which the adoption of the doctrine was done by way of a common law approach, did they address the implications of Trexel?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, many of the cases address the, if I may. I'm going to have to pull out the reading glasses, which apparently broke in my pocket. Okay. Okay. It's my recollection that the In Re Parentage of LB specifically addressed Trexel. And sorry. I think Middleton. Sorry to keep the court waiting. Yeah, I'm fairly certain those two definitely affected Trexel, or addressed Trexel. Rubano v. DiCenzo, which is from Rhode Island also. Having trouble reading my writing. I think In Re ELMC, and again, the reason that Trexel is not violated, or the doctrine, parental rights are not infringed, are one, because that the parent has deliberately brought in the other parent. So there was consent to the development of the relationship. Certainly, you can't just go out and kidnap a kid and develop a parent-child relationship. That doesn't fly. But when the legal parent does invite and foster and encourage the relationship, then you're not infringing on the rights by continuing that relationship. And at least one court, and I believe it was Washington, which would be then In Re Parentage of LB, held that... My mistake. Delaware, Smith v. Guest, that because a de facto parent is a parent as well, they have the same constitutional privilege. Delaware court went that far.
I guess my struggle with your argument on de facto parenting is we have NRS 125C004 that says a person who is not the parent can be awarded custody, but for that to occur, there must be, without the consent of the parents, for that to occur, there must be a finding that award of custody to the parent would be detrimental to the child. And if we credit your position, aren't we really then saying we're kind of making that statute nugatory?
Well, there. One, you could not be making it nugatory by saying that if that parent is unwilling to allow the relationship that he or she had previously fostered, encouraged to develop, that would be detrimental to the child, assuming the facts support that severance of the relationship would cause harm to the child. And that's going to be a very case-specific determination. But the other, you're actually addressing the point. Why should a child who, from the age of 2 months, had two parents, not be permitted to continue that relationship when a child who from birth had those two parents, where the only difference is a formal agreement to adopt.
Right. I take your point, but just it's problematic because we have that statute, and we do have a statute, I agree with you, that permits visitation, which is really a species of custody, so it's kind of peculiar anyway.
A very different species, if I may, Your Honor.
But it seems as though the legislature has spoken on this and declared the policy balances, so it makes me a little uneasy to add to that.
Then I would suggest, Your Honor, you would need to walk back Nguyen, because Nguyen was making the same policy leap that you're talking about.
Yeah.
The difference there was a formal agreement to adopt, which doesn't address that statute at all. And again,
in for penny, in for pound.
Well, or do we want the same benefits for all children? Do we want the best interest to apply?
Unless there's additional questions, this time, we're going to give you 2 minutes for rebuttal with this.
Thank you very much.
And counsel will give you some additional time.
Good afternoon. My name is Ken Ward, and I'm representing Stacy Mathis, the respondent. A lot of the questions I think that were asked are appropriate. I was struggling with the issue of basically a constitutional right of a parent, a natural parent, to determine what's best for his or her child. It's maybe I'm just traditional. I probably am. That's why I got the gray hair. But it would seem to me that to adopt either the equitable adoption idea or the, well, in particular, I don't think the equitable adoption doesn't apply. There was never an agreement to adopt. So I think that that's pretty much clear that it's not there, according to the Hermanson case and some of the others. As far as the, I was thinking about the equal protection issue, and that's not raised in any of the briefs. And would it be appropriate for a mother to file a petition under the de facto parent, and therefore ask for child support? For a determination of who pays the childhood, the child dependency, the IRS deduction. So it would seem that that creates an issue of equal protection. And do we really want to go there when we don't have to? One of the things is 125C does allow anyone to file a petition. I think there's a lot of people that have done that.
Mr. Ward?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. Over here. Sorry. Do you agree, then, that Mr. Silva should have had standing to pursue either custody under .004 or visitation in front of the court?
Under his theory, no. I think he would certainly have standing under 125C because that confers standing on anyone. And I think that is a real significant distinction, and the legislature did in fact confer that to anyone.
So do you agree with your opposing colleague that we should reverse it at minimum on 125C0501?
I think that if there was a petition under 125C, I think that that would be appropriate. That is, in my opinion.
And why should we not read this complaint to at least ask for that at minimum?
I quite frankly, I don't have any issue with following that particular statute. The issue that I have is to go on another theory that involves
126.004, yeah.
Right, and that involves an actual custody determination.
But don't we have that too? Don't we have an allegation of parental unfitness so that you could say, reading the complaint and crediting its allegations broadly, he asserted a statutory claim under, and I may have the numbers wrong, but 126.004, I think is the number.
Right.
So then he would get reversed and remanded on both visitation under 125C and 126 custody of the 0041.
Well, that may be correct, and I think it is. However, I think the issue that I'm coming across is if it's under the existing statutory scheme that the legislature has put in place, I think that's fine. But for us to fashion an additional remedy, which brings into play
Well, we don't know yet whether, and I take a page out of Justice Hardesty's questions here, we don't know whether the allegation of parental unfitness is even going to be creditable. And until we know it, we don't know why we would need to go anywhere other than 125C or 126004, right?
Yes. I think that, the way I read this, I think this should be remanded at any rate. But as far as for the reasons that it should be remanded, I think we should appropriately constrain ourselves to just the statutory language as it exists now. We don't need to take that extra step. When the language is purely, it is unambiguous, that's what we do. And that's my opinion. And I know that when I first realized that this was on an appeal, I was somewhat dumbfounded, quite frankly. And upon further review, it does appear that some jurisdictions may have done this. But I don't think that other jurisdictions is Nevada. Nevada has the Wynn case, Hermanson, and all the others involving equitable adoption, which I don't think applies in this case at any rate. So the issue is whether or not we're going to have as case law in this state, that a de facto parent is a viable option when that same determination can be made under 125C. It's under a child support issue, it's kind of an iffy thing as well. If you can have two fathers, then there certainly should be two child supports. Or on the opposite side, if the mother thinks that, and this happens occasionally, a person does not get divorced establishes a relationship with another person who establishes a relationship with the child, then what we have is we could have a de facto parent and a natural parent. Where does that go? It's just it's hard for me to visualize how any decision other than the one that applies 125C would be of assistance to anyone out there. So I know that you have some questions for me, but I'm here.
Well, Mr. Ward, I'm sorry. So the court didn't reach the issue of custody as an interested person. Is that correct? Because Mr. Silva approached it as, I want custody and visitation because I am a presumed parent.
Correct.
So should this court reverse and remand for the court to consider it under 125C? Or?
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate, quite frankly. I really do. That would not harm the statutory scheme that the legislature has. If they want to change it, they can do it. But the statute 125C is very, very broad in its application. So I think it would cover every single one of the elements of the parent in fact or de facto parent that's here.
Mr. Ward, in your review of some of the cases on de facto parent, have you seen any case that addresses the what I'll call the flip hypothetical, where dad and his son move in with a new girlfriend and they establish a relationship for 3 or 4 years, and then girlfriend holds the son out and so on and so forth, and they separate, and now dad goes after mom or the girlfriend for child support? Have you seen a hypothetical where this doctrine has been applied that way?
I have not, but that doesn't mean it's not out there. Yeah. I'm not all seeing, that's for sure. Uh-huh. I think that ties into the equal protection argument that we have, that I presented. It's not there. Mm-hmm. There would be, if the court accepts the theory of a de facto parent, I don't see how that would not be a viable option to avoid any equal protection argument.
Now, my understanding is the district court found no standing because the district court read the complaint to address paternity, that it was basically just seeking these remedies on the strength of paternity, and that that obviously wasn't present.
Correct. If I may, there's another.
But you're willing to concede that a claim under 125C or 124C or whatever the number is could be remanded back, notwithstanding the way the complaint is currently articulated.
And that's I understand that. However, to make things simpler, my thought was that it is an appropriate allegation under 125C.
Mm-hmm.
That's not there. It was brought up in my brief. And I, it's easier to do that than to have the issues in that case are pretty much the same in the 125C as it would be here.
And am I wrong that this originated out of the only thing that was actually challenged was venues? So we're reviewing a complaint that was dismissed on an oral motion challenging standing that the judge took and ran with, where the real challenge that was articulated was venue. And Mr. Silva was there pro se, saying, wait a minute, this wasn't what I was prepared to address. So to me, it seems much fairer to allow this to be pleaded, be read expansively, and if there are legal flaws with the theories articulated, those could be explored on motion that's written and reviewed.
I think that's true. I was surprised that issue came up, too. When, I mean, I flew into Las Vegas, and the council here did, to address that, and I was under the impression that we were just there on the venue issue, and there was a timely demand, motion of demand
right.
To change the venue. It was me. And it was kind of brought up, and then I shouldn't have, but I did. I should have said, wait, you know, but I did.
But it would be very venturesome for us to get off into de facto parenting on this record, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I you know, I don't think anyone was ready to argue that particular thing. I certainly wasn't, just based upon the fact that the way that I felt it was to natural parent rules. And so, you know, it's a hornet's nest.
Well, in fairness to the parties, the judge jumped to standing, but is the venue correct on this thing?
No.
Yeah, that's still an open issue,
yeah.
Too.
No, see, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, we're not even in the right district. We're not. Probably shouldn't be in the Supreme Court. We're not in the right district court.
Well, that's. I was going to bring that up, but now that you mentioned, in fact, I did the case that established the motion and demand for change of venue. This was 1995 or something.
Mm-hmm.
That said that once that is done, it's basically a ministerial act to sign the order to transfer jurisdiction, and the rules in the Fifth Judicial District. In Nye County, where even on a motion and a demand for change of venue, which is ordinarily just done, there had to be a notice to set, and which I did a little bit later. But
there's not an appeal from that either by you.
No, because the way I figured it, if this thing was going to be remanded, the whole case would be remanded. But then I don't think it would affect the motion and demand for change of venue.
Okay, because you're saying it was not decided because standing was decided.
Correct.
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know either. There's a lot of things I don't know.
I just worry that these folks are trying to get on with their lives and we're balled up in a big old legal mess and now we got lawyers spending more time and more money and it would be nice to figure out a pragmatic solution to get over all these procedural humps and let folks get to the merits?
Well, I think the best way is just to, for this court to issue an order that basically affirms the fact that parent in fact is not applicable in this case. Just say, however, based upon the record, it appears there's an adequate statutory remedy in 125C, and leave it at that.
But we wouldn't need to go to the de facto parenting. I mean, no. That would be purely advisory on our part, and it would be ill-advised because it would create more argument where perhaps other doctrines are sufficient.
Well, I agree with that. And, you know,
maybe it wouldn't be if it was a pretrial writ.
I'm sorry.
Like those, if it had been a pretrial writ. A writ saying we should adopt a de facto adoption, de facto parenting.
I don't know if that would be a subject to an extraordinary writ.
But we have some of my colleagues believe we should.
Well, I kind of try to avoid those.
In proper venue should reside.
I'm sorry.
Where did you maintain proper venue should reside?
In Lyon County.
Lyon County.
The defendant, my client, lived in Stagecoach, Nevada.
Okay.
Which is in Lyon County.
All right. And that was the notice you had filed.
Yes.
Is that in this record, that notice?
I believe it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything additional for us, or my colleagues have questions?
Well, I think every one of the justices pretty much asked all the questions that I was going to bring up. So we're good to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If we reverse on the 125 and send it back for 125, 126 venue and standing, could Mr. Silva amend to ask for the adoption of de facto parenting?
So we get the whole bunch. I don't actually know that he would need to amend because I think he already asked for it. He just didn't use those words. But yes, I would hope that. Trial, that he will have the opportunity to have trial counsel. I can tell you it's not going to be me because this is my venue. I say that because I'm not a trial attorney. But I hope he will have representation below.
Ms. Cowden, do you have the authority to agree or not that proper venue in this case belongs in Lyon County based on the statute and based on your understanding of the residency of the parties?
I have not been given that authority from my client.
Okay.
I don't know that it would be imposed in the circumstances here, but I can tell you I don't have that authority.
Okay.
But to the extent there was a rejection implicit in the dismissal of the change of venue motion, there was no appeal from that either. So, I mean, it's arguable both ways. It's the problem.
I'll stay silent on that and look at for a future argument. I have my opinion on it, but yes, there was no cross appeal.
Okay.
But I do have to say, in fairness to Mr. Ward, that
his complaint was dismissed. So implicit in that is it's not venued anywhere.
The district court asked him to make an oral motion, but it was essentially sua sponte. This was not this wasn't by his design. It was the district court who didn't recognize the existing jurisdiction. But there are a few things I want to say. First of all, some of the concerns that Mr. Ward raised about the equitable adoption issue.
Finish your thought.
They already exist. It's not only a mother who seeks child support, but if a parent seeks child support against a de facto parent, that exists. It's already possible, again, assuming certain statutory requirements are met. And in fact, courts have been much more forgiving in applying equitable adoption in those circumstances because there hasn't been the same sort of requirement for a formal adoption agreement in the same way. The other factors, as I'm not asking this court to make a determination that Mr. Silva is a de facto parent. I'm asking this court to make it clear to the district court that he has the ability and he has standing to make that argument. That is what I'm asking of this court. And I don't think that's an advisory opinion, because he made the allegations sufficient to satisfy the factors in the test that have been adopted by many, many states. And so a recognition by this court that the doctrine is viable is not an advisory opinion.
Don't you think we should say more than just do we adopt the de facto parent doctrine and not list the various issues that need to be proven to allow de facto adoption? I mean, with the Supreme Court, wouldn't it make it better for every district court? I mean, we've got 82.
I think that if the court were to look at its existing equitable doctrine test and were to say that requirement of an agreement to adopt can be done via conduct as well as verbally, that by showing fostering the relationship, you are agreeing to an adoption, I think that is all this court would need to do to bring the children in these circumstances into parenting.
But you're confident that he raised de facto parent in the lower court, whether it be wrongly or rightly. He raised it.
He didn't use the term, but he did say that he had developed, he made all of the allegations that support a de facto parent. He didn't use the term. He's not an attorney. I think he did actually ask for an equitable adoption, though. So, and de facto parent and equitable adoption are akin to each other. I mean, a psychological parent is another term that courts have used. It's all the same sort of thing, the idea that by conduct you've created this relationship.
But equitable, there's an agreement. De facto, there's not an agreement.
No, both cases involve agreement by conduct.
No, but I'm talking about the...
Under Nevada,
yeah.
Under existing Nevada law, yes.
Right.
It must be a formal agreement. Apparently, it doesn't have to be in writing, I don't think, but at least it had to have been articulated in terms of an adoption.
Nice,
so that's the difference.
It's nice to have the last case of the day being challenging everything we've done so far in domestic relations.
With
it's,
that,
it's a challenging field. I'm sorry.
No, I'm closing closing the argument at this point.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the extra time.
Court thanks both counsel for arguments made on this interesting topic this day. This matter will stand submitted.